A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sen. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 23. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about the Omega Factor. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon in England.
Tom Crane is an investigative journalist with developing psychic powers, it seems, who also does writing and journalism about psychic phenomena and the like. And he is recruited to work for Department 7, a mysterious organization somehow within the government which investigates the paranormal.
The Omega Factor is a BBC television series from 1979, and it was a 10-episode series, 10 episodes of 50 minutes each, and as you say, it was very much, this was a paranormal show. This was a show about the paranormal and investigating the paranormal, and as we'll find out as we go along, there's lots of spooky stuff going on. And to sort of guide us through the world, we needed somebody who perhaps knew slightly more about it than we did, the hero of our piece.
And the hero is Tom Crane. Tom Crane was, as we said, a journalist who investigates all of these supernatural type things. At the beginning of the story, he's doing some investigation, and someone who is quite close to him dies. He gradually finds out that some of the people that he knows are involved with this organization called Department 7, and he's gradually pulled in and comes to work for them. Not only does he come to work for them, he becomes obsessed in discovering what happened with this death that we mentioned and following this up and doing these types of things. He also has a brother, Michael Crane, and Michael Crane seems to have some psychic powers of his own. While Tom seems to have greater powers, Michael knew about them before Tom did. Michael actually ends up spending several episodes in hospital because of things going wrong with his powers. So there's some dark things happening here with what goes on with some of these characters. Tom Crane was played by James Hazeldine, and Michael Crane was played by Nicholas Coppin.
So Tom comes to work for Department 7, this mysterious organization, and in classic TV style, he needs to have a partner. And his partner was Dr. Anne Reynolds, who was played by Louise Jameson in her first role, really, I think, after playing Leela, who was the companion or one of the companions for the fourth Doctor Who. And you'll probably, if you know Doctor Who, you'll remember that Leela was the leather-clad barbarian companion who was very popular on the show for a variety of reasons.
She was the savage.
She was the savage, yes. She plays Dr. Anne Reynolds, who is very much a scientist. Tom's a journalist, Anne Reynolds is the scientist. She's actually a physicist, although we don't see her doing an awful lot of physics, but we do see her doing experiments and research. While Tom is sort of in touch with his psychic powers and he's a believer, she's much more sceptical about the paranormal and much more rational in her explanations. And also, as the show goes on, as the 10 episodes go on, there does seem to be the possibility of a romantic interest developing between the two characters.
That's right. It was an interesting combination having Tom Crane and Anne Reynolds, because Anne was clearly a rationalist. She clearly believed in things she could explain, and when there were these strange phenomena, there was some explanation that was just unknown. With Tom, he believed that there were these unexplained things, but when it came down to it individually, he would often be quite skeptical about a number of things that would come up, including his own ability. Someone would say something about him being a powerful psychic, and he'd say, oh, well, yeah, there are some things I can do, but that's all. It was an interesting little combination there. In addition, we had Dr. Roy Martindale, played by John Carlyle, and he was the boss who Anne and Tom worked for. He was a psychiatrist. He was a very ambiguous type of character. He was heading up Department 7, and he was, in many ways, more the true believer than Tom was. He believed in all kinds of strange things that were out there. He frequently conducted experiments, and he was often following up on reports of strange things and then sending Tom and Anne to go out and investigate them.
And we do see him doing lots of strange experiments, as you say, although I don't think it's quite clear what a lot of them are about. We just see him involved in various bits of research, which is rather mysterious.
It's kind of shadowy, isn't it?
It is, yes. And also shadowy and mysterious is another figure called Andrew Scott Erskine, who's a government figure, quite senior. And he, I think, actually is the one who recruits Tom Crane to work for Department 7. And he was played by an actor called Brown Derby. Fantastic name. He's, at one hand, he seems to be Martindale's sort of boss in authority in the government. And then on the other hand, he's a strange figure who occasionally pops up in a trench coat to give Tom information. Very much, in a way, he reminded me of sort of Deep Throat from All the President's Men and the Watergate stuff. He's that sort of character who sort of turns up when they need a bit of information to drive the plot along.
Andrew Scott Erskine is just plain creepy. He's a very creepy character who shows up and is the type of person who unnerves everyone else in the room. And it's played that way, and you can tell that no one is quite comfortable when they're there in a conversation with Andrew Scott Erskine.
It's difficult to work out his motivations, isn't it?
It is. And it's like Royal Martindale unnerves people, and Andrew Scott Erskine unnerves people even more.
And then we have two other quite creepy and unnerving characters as well.
Yes, one is Edward Drexel, played by Cyril Luckham, who was the White Guardian on Doctor Who in the 70s and 80s. And he was a major recurring villain in the early part of the stories, and he was responsible for, or may have been responsible for, one or more deaths of various people, and Tom blamed him very strongly, and it was that blaming Drexel and the death that was close to Tom that motivated Tom to go and join Department 7, because he wasn't too comfortable with Department 7, but he wanted to go up against Drexel and hunt down Drexel and get him dealt with.
And I think it's slightly easier to see Drexel's motivations, in a way, that he's the bad guy.
Yes.
He's our villain here. And he's a very memorable villain. He is, again, he's another creepy character who's very powerful, and he's quite unpleasant. And he has an assistant, a young woman called Morang, who was actually played by one of the show creator's daughter, an actress called Natasha Gerson. And she's a very mysterious figure as well. She very rarely speaks. I think she has a couple of lines in the shop in the first episode, and she hardly says anything. And her role is of some form of assistant or almost a familiar to Drexel. And she crops up from time to time as the show goes on. And basically, whenever she crops up, something bad is going to happen.
That's right. She seems to have powers of her own. She's some sort of medium or something. It isn't exactly clear what she is.
Yeah, I think that's right. Medium's probably a good description. She's some sort of medium for Drexel and his powers through her, possibly, or her own powers that he uses.
We found your articles in the occult most entertaining, but the next series of articles should prove of far greater interest and import.
How do you know?
Following up the work the Russians and Americans are doing, an investigation of the paranormal, ESP, psychokinesis, clairvoyance, and so on. Actually, we were first in the field some years ago. That is what Department 7 is. We experiment and investigate such phenomena.
And now I'm involved because I propose to write about it.
You are involved because you also possess certain abilities. You're a comparatively rare creature, Mr. Crane. A genuine psychic. A good sensitive.
Well, if I am, it's something I've developed recently, I'm sure.
I think so. Neither does Roy Martindale, incidentally. Oh, yes, he works for the department also. In fact, he heads our Edinburgh team, of which your friend, Dr. Anne Reynolds, is a member.
Anne?
Yes. We've known of your abilities for some time, Mr. Crane.
How the hell could you have known?
It is a part of your early childhood which your memory has rejected.
So, how do you know about it?
Your mother confided in Julia.
She never told me.
I did say confided.
But she told you.
For the best of reasons.
So we have got some quite memorably creepy characters. And as you say, we start with the first episode, which was quite impressive. You know, it certainly set the story off. And there's a death and there's unpleasantness. And Tom is driven to join Department 7 and pursue Drexel. And then what happens is we go off on the next 9 episodes. And in each episode, basically, to begin with, they'll start investigating some aspect of the paranormal. So we'll get an episode where they'll be concentrating on telepathy or picking up psychic phenomena. We get episodes about spooky voices being recorded on tape, the sort of electronic voice phenomena stuff, which is quite creepy, with strange noises and things going bump. And we also get episodes about hypnosis and mind control, brainwashing, that sort of thing.
Yeah, we get things like poltergeists and possession, out-of-body experiences, seances, and a lot of these sort of classic paranormal things, but being examined in a very sort of careful and serious way.
And there's the government working on experimental weapons with the army, and the secrecy and mystery, and Tom and Anne are trying to figure out what's going on.
And as things develop, there are a number of ongoing plot lines that run from the beginning of the series to the end through the 10 episodes of this one season. And one of them is about this conspiracy, this organization that calls themselves Omega. They appear on and off gradually, and Tom becomes convinced that this organization is real, that it has people inside Department 7, and that they are taking this information that was legitimately gathered for the government, as Department of Seven is part of the government. Tom believes this organization is there misusing this information. And on the whole, no one believes him.
Yeah, he gets dismissed most of the time when he brings it up. And it works quite well. We've got the individual episodes with their theme of various aspects of the paranormal and the investigation. But also we've got this sort of ongoing story arc developing about this mysterious group that might be behind all this. The Omega Group and the Omega Factor. The Omega Factor, the TV series, was produced by a chap called George Galassio, which I hope I'm pronouncing right, who'd previous to the show had actually been a production manager on Doctor Who. And he was handed this slot in the BBC schedule. I think initially the plan was for him to produce another series of an existing television show about a newspaper office. But that hadn't been terribly successful.
So it didn't get a second season, that's right.
No, that's right. No second season for that one. But they still had the slot in the schedule. And they said, well, you've got the slot, find something to put in it. So he then had to turn to somebody to come up with a show concept.
That's right. He had this situation, the newspaper drama was called The Standard, and they were going to give it a second season, but it wasn't that successful. So they were given this 13-episode slot with enough budget for a newspaper drama. And this morphed into 10 episodes with the same budget as 13 for the newspaper office, and then they may have improved on that budget a little bit. But George Galassio turned to Jack Gerson, who was a writer, and Gerson had been interested in the paranormal and specifically wanted to treat it seriously, wanted to write a series that was for adults and looked at paranormal phenomena and looked at them darkly and looked at them as a serious thing and didn't make light of it. And that was what evolved into the Omega Factor.
And he wrote the first episode. That really set it up, as we've discussed. That sets up Tom and Department 7 and his hunt for Drexel, and also hints of the conspiracy that are going to emerge as the show continues. But the other episodes were written by basically a whole bunch of different writers. I think Gerson returns to write the last episode, and then in the meantime they passed it on to a number of different writers, one of whom was a chap called Anthony Reed. He wrote certainly one of the most controversial episodes, the fifth one, Powers of Darkness, which we'll talk about in a moment. And he was another graduate from Doctor Who. He was, I think he was a script editor for a while on Doctor Who. And then they had several directors. They didn't have a single director for the whole show. They had, I think, a different director for each episode, with even George Galassio directing the last episode himself. But again, if you look at the biographies of the people who directed it, nearly all of them had worked on Doctor Who previous to coming to the Omega Factor. I suppose it's no surprise if you've got a weekly television show that runs for 26 years that it's going to be, in a way, the nursery slopes for so much of the stuff that so many of the people that we've been talking about in British Invaders.
Yes, for sure. This was also right around the time of the peak popularity of Doctor Who in the late 70s, and Doctor Who was a very big deal then. The Omega Factor was produced by BBC Scotland, and the location shooting, of which there was a great deal, was mostly done in Edinburgh. The architecture of Edinburgh, with tall Victorian buildings and railways and narrow alleys and courtyards and this old sort of feel, was really a strong part of it. It was not that common for you to see modern-looking buildings and modern-looking architecture in the Omega Factor. It was really built around seeing old things. In some episodes, they went outside of the city, and you had this wonderful, spectacular-looking countryside out in Scotland with the rolling hills. And that was something that was really nice that wouldn't have been available to them so easily if this were being shot at the studio in London.
But as you say, the Edinburgh stuff looks fantastic. I mean, Edinburgh looks great in this series.
Yes, it does.
And again, it was unusual. It was, you know, unusual to see a show that wasn't set in London.
That's right. Yeah, they definitely used it to their advantage. They shot in Edinburgh and made it set in Edinburgh and used just the right locations and the right places there to give it that old sort of look, and to give it that look that was just what they needed.
And it adds to the sort of creepy feeling. The very sort of gothic architecture of Edinburgh sort of adds to the mood of it and the intensity. And as you say, also, when they get out into the countryside, that looks very good as well. And Tom and Anne, for some reason, they seem to end several episodes with them having a walk in the country.
Yes, that's true.
And reflecting on the events, and have the fact that they, once again, they haven't learned the whole truth and there's still the conspiracy.
It had a bit of the feel to me that they were out walking in the country, because there they couldn't be eavesdropped upon by people in the buildings and things like that. That was my feel, but it's hard to say.
Maybe that's what it was.
Who knows?
I think some of the studio work looks a bit dull in comparison. Some of the interiors are a bit boring compared with the outdoor shooting in Edinburgh and in the surrounding countryside.
Yes. Something they did that was unusual at the time, not unheard of, but pretty unusual, was that the entire series, or almost the entire series, was shot on videotape. At the time, usually all of the interior studio work would be done on video, and the exteriors and sometimes interior location work, but certainly the exterior location work, would be shot on 16mm film. In this case, they used very little 16mm film, and they shot the exteriors on video. And that gave you a very consistent look to the quality of the images in the exteriors and the interiors. And that was something that was very nice, that had a good look to it. If you listen to some of the things that the people who worked on this series have said, they found that the Scottish team they had there in BBC Scotland was very good for a few reasons. One was that they had the same team working on the interior video and the exterior video, so it really gave them a look to how things were constructed and how they were shot. It was also something that worked well because the Scottish team was apparently very willing to go the extra mile for them and would do some things that were challenging or stretching what could be done, sometimes with some pretty good results. You had things like the lighting department doing some very dark and well-controlled lighting, and all of these things fitting together.
Yes, it was. I think it was, as you say, it was a different team. They were perhaps quite pleased to get a big production, and therefore they threw themselves into it with gusto and gave it a strange sort of different feel to something we'd normally see at this time in the late 1970s. But of course, the production didn't go entirely smoothly for them, did it?
Not entirely, no. There were some things that happened that some people claim there were unexplained phenomena when they'd be dealing with the occult or strange things on set. Some people claim that there were equally strange things that actually happened to them, like a particularly intense climax scene and one of the lights spontaneously exploded and showered glass everywhere. Someone claimed that her car started on its own, and there was an episode with a seance in it, and someone said that they thought the table was actually levitating a little bit, or something of that sort.
On the DVD extras, you get some of the production team talking about the various things that went on. And as you say, you know, lights go in and there was a costume that disappeared. And I think the problem is, though, that if you're making a paranormal or a spooky show, it's just, I think, natural for people to associate anything that goes wrong with the theme of the show. Whereas if you were making an episode of, you know, Poirot or Inspector Morse, you would just say, oh, it's the light's gone, somebody change the bulb, please.
No one particularly pays attention when one costume disappears and no one's sure where it went. But if you're doing the Omega Factor, that's a big deal, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, the same stories go around about the film The Exorcist, about all the strange things that happened during the production of The Exorcist. Although I think several people, including the director, have pointed out, you know, if you put that many people together for a year working on a production,
right,
various things are going to happen. But there you go. There was also a book of the Omega Factor. There was one novel written by Jack Gerson, the guy who'd come up with the concept and written the first episode. So he wrote a novel that was available at the time with a TV tie-in cover. It's no longer available. It's out of print, although you can track it down through the various second-hand booksellers. I haven't read it, but I gather he took the story for the first episode, which is a, you know, very dramatic story. There's death. There's a very impressive scene where Tom's hunting down, he's using his developing powers to try and track down a missing woman, and it sets up this very powerful villain, Drexel. And then I think the book then continues with that story rather than going into the next few episodes of the TV series. And so the hunt for Drexel continues in a slightly different direction, and from what I gather, leads up to a big confrontation.
It's also almost of note that this one novel is just about the only spin-off effort that there is out there for the Omega Factor.
It was it's strange because it's, as you say, 10 episodes, one book to tie in, and then it disappears for 25 years, the series?
Something like that.
Yeah, 25 years it was in the wilderness, and you couldn't see it. It wasn't repeated. It wasn't available on video until 2006.
That's right. It had one broadcast in 79. I'm not aware of any international broadcasts even. And then it showed up on DVD in about 2006, and there was nothing in between.
And of course, that just heightened the mystery about the series.
Oh, absolutely. But I think that covers it for the first half of our discussion here. You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. So, this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
And this is Eamon from England, saying goodbye until next time.